Today, we're going to start off by talking about debt, and Kirk's going to go over saving and investing, and then I'm going to finish us off going over insurance planning and estate planning, and we're calling that legacy. So today, when we get into debt, what is debt? We're going to talk about what it means to be held to a master other than our Lord, and that's getting enslaved to debt and how that's not a good thing. We'll talk about how credit cards work and the dangers, and then also how credit cards can be used well. So there are ways that credit cards aren't all bad all the time. And then if we have some time, we'll get into car ownership and home ownership. We're going to try and get there. I have some slides on that I think will be helpful. And we'll also talk about strategies on how to get out of debt. If you're currently in debt, there are some good strategies that we'll go through and talk about that. So we're going to start talking about unwise debt because, like I just mentioned, there are some debts that can be used for good. I mean, home ownership is a good thing. But most of us start off with not being able to afford a $400,000 or $500,000 house in our area. That's a decent house. 300, I think, maybe is the bare minimum these days. But most of us don't have that much money laying around to pay cash for a home right away. So getting a mortgage is a type of debt that is not so unwise. So I want to start it off by reading Proverbs 22, verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. So we want to think about that when we get into debt. We don't want to become that slave to another master besides our Lord, right? By getting into debt, it creates this dark cloud over us, and we get into this feeling like we owe someone something, and we do. Anytime we get into debt, we're obligated to have to pay that. So no matter what, you're not going to just get your debt forgiven. There are some exceptions to that, but most of the time, almost all the time, you're going to have to pay the debt that you've gotten yourself into. So that's important to understand before you get into that debt and before you're making the decisions. Do I really need this? Is this a good debt? If I don't have the money to buy it, is it really a good thing? So reasonable debt versus regrettable debt. So reasonable debt, first, the Bible doesn't really tell us that debt is sinful per se. Some things, when we get into large amounts of debt that might not be good debt, can lead to us sinning. But debt being sinful is not explicitly said in the Bible. And it's not always wrong if done with properly. Okay? So some examples of reasonable debt would be buying assets that appreciate in value, like home ownership. Okay? That would be a good debt to purchase because, especially in our area, most of the time homes go up in value. There's been a couple of times where houses have gone down for a short time on the county appraisal district, but for the most part, every year your house is going to go up in value, especially in our DFW market. We're blessed to be in this area. People are moving here, which is making the home prices go up, and if you own a home, you're going to continue to see that appreciation. Other reasonable debts on a depreciation side that might not be such a bad debt is like car ownership. Car ownership depreciates at a slower rate, so that's not a bad thing to be in. We all need cars. Reasonable debt when it comes to cars. So you're going to hear me say the word reasonable a lot because it's easy to get into debt and start being greedy and say, I need more and more and more, but we have to be reasonable with the debt we get into and make sure that we can actually afford what we're doing. Now, here's some other reasonable debt, and I have an example for this. So I entered into the partnership at my firm a couple of years ago, and so to do that, I didn't have the cash to be able to purchase that large asset. Well, that was a business loan that I received. So I have a business loan, and the cash flow that I receive from the ownership of that business now and that partnership is helping me pay for that loan. Now, if we have the mentality that all debt is bad debt, then how would I have done that? I wouldn't have been able to because I don't have the cash to do that, or it might take me 15 or 20 years to be able to afford to do that. So by having that mentality that all debt is bad debt can harm you in some instances. So for my example, entering into that partnership, I have an asset backing that up in that business loan because the cash flow from the business is being able to pay off my business debt that I received. Now, there is risk to that. If the business doesn't do well, if something happens in the economy, and I mean, my business is very fluctuating on the economy and the stock market, so there are risks. And so there were things that were put in place in that business loan that helped me alleviate some of those risks. I'm not saying all of them, but some of them were removed. But you have to think about that, even when a business loan. So again, reasonableness. So there are business loans that aren't so good, and it could be very painful for you getting in debt. So just be careful when you get in debt. Education loans. How many of us have education loans? Not very many of us. That's great. I just paid off my last one in December, so I'm thankful to be out of that realm. But education loans can be a good debt to have. And the reason I say that is because if it helps you generate higher income. Now, if we go and get a student loan for $100,000 or $150,000, and it doesn't do anything for our wages to increase, then that probably wasn't a good debt to be in. But investing in human capital is a real thing, and having an education is good if we use it, and we're not just going out and getting student loans to get student loans. I had a friend in college who utilized his student loans for excess living and got as much money as he possibly could, and back then, student loans have changed a bit since then, but back then you could pretty much get a student loan. And so he racked up all this debt, but he lived a lavish lifestyle in college and called it student loans. Well, now he's in it well into his 30s, and that's not such a good thing because he's still in it. He's continuing to rack up his interest rate. So again, reasonableness. It can be used for good. It can be used not so well. And the last thing on this slide on reasonable debt, things to keep in mind, is managing your interest rates and payments, okay? So a lot of the times when we go and purchase a car or something, they might, I don't know, last time I purchased a car and I got a loan, the salesman tried to get me to extend out. Oh, well, if you just extend out, you can buy this extra warranty. You can do this. You just tack all this onto the loan. It's not going to change your payment. You're like, yeah, but my payment went from 60 months to 84 months to keep my payment the same. And you have to be aware of that because that's not a good thing. So we want to be reasonable when we're looking at the payments, and we want to be reasonable when we're looking at interest rates, okay? So what are some regrettable debts? And the biggest thing is going to be credit card debt. Okay, credit cards can be very, very, very harmful to us. There's a lot of people that get into credit card debt, and it's a big hole to dig out of. It's really hard to get out of. We're going to go into this a lot deeper in just a minute. The other things are toys that can be really high interest rate that are a little higher risk. An easy example is buying a boat. The kind of typical saying is the best day of a boat owner's life is the day he bought it, and the second best day is the day he sold it. Take that with whatever you think, but I mean, any type of big toy like that that you're having to put debt on just to have it, might be a better idea to save up for that toy and then purchase it at that point. Because that would mean, okay, I can really afford this. All right, so the dangers of debt. Like I mentioned before, it positions us under a new master. Okay, it presumes on the future. So we're presuming that we're going to be able to continue making these payments. Well, what happens if we lose our job? Well, we're still obligated to that debt. Again, back to the spending plan. If we have that properly planned for and allocated, we have to make sure we continue to pay our debts. Okay. And it can promote greed rather than contentment. So thinking about credit card debt is, okay, my neighbor next door has all these fancy things and is constantly going and doing things. My income doesn't support that. My spending plan doesn't support that. Well, I've got this shiny credit card in my back pocket, so I want to be able to be like them. Okay, so it's starting to promote greed. I need more and more and more. And you're not content in the Lord and what he's given you to steward. So that's very important, one of the big dangers of risk. And why a lot of people mention, hey, just don't get into debt. Don't have it. Some people just can't handle debt, and they get into a hole, and their personality just doesn't allow them to get back in, out of it. All right, transitioning into credit cards and what they are. So a credit card is revolving credit. So you have a limit that the bank gives you, whether however much it is, whatever you qualify for. Let's say it's $10,000. So you start using that credit card on purchases, and you go up to $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 in a month, and you pay $1,000. Well, you can only get up to that $10,000, but it's revolving, meaning that it's always there. That $10,000 is always there, and depending on how much of it you use, is how much left you have on the credit card. Maxing out a credit card would mean using all $10,000. Okay, not a good thing. You see that second bullet point right there. If the balance is not paid off each month, there are high interest rates. So credit cards can be used well. If you pay it off each month, you're not incurring that interest rate. A lot of people think if you use a credit card, you're automatically being charged interest. That's not true. If you pay it off every month, then there's no interest accrued with that credit card. But they are very high interest rates. I think most credit cards, when you look, this says 15 to 30%. Most of them are on that plus 25% side. And then that third bullet point right there, minimum payments often lead to excessive debt, making purchases more and more expensive than it was originally. And there's a good example we're about to go through. Okay, so why are they dangerous? Paying high interest rate payments means less money for giving, family needs, furthering the kingdom, because if you have to pay $200 or $300 extra just to meet the minimum payment on your credit cards that you've racked up over the years, then that takes away from that spending plan. That's an expense that goes on your budget. So we can't do the things that we desire to do if we've gotten an amount of debt. Okay, what we talked about before, I wanted to point out this verse, Proverbs 21:20. It says, precious treasures and oil are in a wise man's dwelling, but a foolish man devours it. It gets into that impulse spending and saying that, hey, we can have these things, but if we just use it up really quick, it's going to continue to make us less and less content, more and more greedy. Okay? So it allows a sense of greed, wanting material things over what God has already provided for us. Okay? And it has a false sense of wealth. So I mentioned this earlier with the neighbor and trying to make sure you're keeping up with what the neighbor has and doing what the neighbor has told us that we see. And it's perceived a lot of the times. And lifestyle creep can get into that. And so what that means is, hey, oh, I'm making a little bit more money, but I want to spend a little bit more money. And that lifestyle continues to go up and up and up and up. And you'll get to a point where, well, I can't afford this anymore, so I've got to break out the credit card, or I got to go get a personal loan, or I really want that Mercedes instead of the Toyota, so I'm going to get a little bit higher debt. It means a little bit higher payment. So that lifestyle creep is a real danger that debt can help us fall into. All right, here's a great example. So when Kirk and I met on Tuesday, he was like, where's the example of the credit card? He was like, you got to put it in there. So I went back and found it, and I agree with him. I think it's really good. So let's kind of set the stage here on what we could do with $5,000 on a credit card. Let's pretend, I know Shepherd's Conference was this last week. Let's say, hey, we're gung-ho, we're going to California. We want to go to Shepherd's Conference, and we might not be able to afford it. So we're going to, but you know, this might be the last year MacArthur's preaching, and so we have to go. We have to go this time. And so you borrow $5,000 on your credit card, and your flights, your food, your lodging, the amount of books you want to buy while you're there. I mean, the bookstores are crazy, so you put it all on the credit card. So you've spent $5,000 on the credit card on debt when you get back, okay? Let's say we're going to be generous, and the credit card company is only going to charge you 21% instead of, I don't know, 28, 29% like a lot of them are nowadays. And you're just going to make the minimum payment, and a lot of those average around 2% of the debt. Who can tell me what they think that $5,000 they're going to end up paying for that trip to California to go to Shepherd's Conference this year? Anyone have any ideas on that $5,000 and what they pay? Kirk's not allowed to answer. No, total. What is that trip to California? It cost you $5,000 today on the credit card, but what is that really? Over $10,000. Okay, what is another answer? Guess it. $8,000. Okay, $8,000. Remember, we're paying the minimum payment. $15,000. Jackson says $15,000. All right. All right, so $25,000. All right. Now, how long do we think it's going to take us to pay off that trip to California? 7 years, 10 years. Any other guesses? Okay, those are all great guesses. Now, let's see what the answers are. So that's going to take 30 years to pay off that trip to California. Okay? It's also going to cost you, in reality, over $26,000, that trip. So the question was, is the credit card company sending you notices saying, hey, you're past due, you need to pay this, you're paying all this interest? The answer to that is no. You're in good standing with the credit card company because you continue to make the minimum payment. So the bank is benefiting from this. This is what they want to happen, because that $5,000 that they lent you, they're going to receive $21,000 in interest over the next 30 years. All right. Now, how do we use credit card debt wisely? So that's an important thing. How do we use it wisely? Because there are ways to use it wisely. I use my credit card for everything. I put everything on my credit card and I pay it off every month. And there are reasons why I do that. I have the discipline where I'm able to pay it off each month because I'm not using it to buy anything excessive. So I don't go to Bass Pro Shop and say, oh, there's a nice gun that I want to purchase and spend $2,500 or $3,000 on a gun because my credit card limit allows me to do that. No, if I go to Bass Pro, I'm there for a specific reason. I'm not just going to shop. There's other Apple Store or whatever else. It can be used for you individually on what you like to do, but it's easy to just swipe that card because you view the limit. The way I view a credit card is, okay, I know in my budget I have this much money that is going to my everyday expenses that I would have to do anyway. I would have to swipe a debit card or pay in cash or something, and that in my head is my limit, not what the credit card company tells me is my limit. And there are times at the 20th, 25th of the month where we're getting close to that, and my wife sit down and say, hey, we're getting close to what we need to be spending this month on the credit card, so we make sure we have enough to pay it off. So communication is key, and just being aware of where you are in the month. Again, why it's good to be tracking those expenses weekly and monthly on that spending plan that I know you all started last month. All right. So leveraging rewards. Credit cards are great because a lot of them have really good rewards. The one I have is more of a travel card, so I get money back and points so I can redeem them on travel. So my family and I are most likely going this spring to Arizona, and almost all of our entire trip, lodging and flight, are going to be paid for by credit card points. And that's just over time, using them wisely, they can be very beneficial. There are a lot of cash back cards that are out there that you can use, and they have very, very good programs. But again, if you cannot be disciplined, don't use them. These benefits don't outweigh the discipline that you have to have. So if you're like, you know what, I've been in credit card debt before, but these benefits sound really good, what Quinn told me this week, I think I can do it. Most likely, you won't be able to. If you've been in that before, you're going to get into it again. So, building necessary credit for future purchases. This is a good one. So this is one thing that I'm very thankful my parents did whenever I was in high school. My mom traveled a lot for work, and every time she got gas, she took out a credit card in my name. Every time she got gas, this is just small little purchases, she would use that card in my name. She did the same thing for my brother. And so whenever we got out of high school, we had some established credit, okay? I have a friend couple that live out in West Texas, and their parents are extremely adverse to debt. And so whenever they bought their first house, they had zero credit. And so they had to get co-signers and different things on their house because they had no credit. And the bank was like, we're not lending you any money. You have nothing. There's nothing to show for anything. And they were just that adverse to risk and debt. So again, it can be used well and for necessary future purchases because we, in America, we have to have credit and it needs to be good credit. And so this is one way that you can do that wisely and well. Okay, and then emergency protection. So if something happens and there's fraud on your credit card companies, there's a barrier between your bank account and the credit card. So most of the time, the credit card company, you call them and say, hey, this was fraud. They credit it back. You don't owe the money. A debit card is a little bit harder to get money back because that's coming directly from your bank account. I'm not saying that the banks won't put the money back, but it is a little bit more difficult. So there is some protection against fraud on credit cards that are a little bit better than debit cards. All right. So now let's say that we actually got into a bunch of credit card and what is a good debt payoff strategy. So the two most popular ways of tackling debt are the snowball method and the avalanche method. Okay, I'm a proponent of the snowball method. So what the snowball method is, and you can see those points there, is you have, let's say you have 10 debts, whether it's credit cards, home, cars, whatever else, a boat. Those debts all have interest rates, okay? So it doesn't matter what the interest rates are in the snowball method, but let's say I have a credit card that's only $1,000, I have a student loan that's $10,000, I have a car that's $20,000, and then I have a home that's $300,000. Well, and I have $500 a month extra to pay onto those debts, and I'm committed to getting out of debt. What I'm going to do is I'm going to look at the smallest debt amount, so that $1,000 credit card. So I'm going to put that $500 extra that I have onto that credit card until it's paid off. That's a small win. So in our heads, we know, hey, I've paid off this debt. I can do it. That's one down, three to go. Then I take whatever that minimum payment was plus my $500, and I start shoveling that to the student loan. Okay, so that was $10,000. Then I'm tackling the next biggest one. Okay, then I go all whatever my minimum payment was for my student loan plus my extra $500 plus the minimum payment to that credit card then goes to my student loan or my car payment, I'm sorry. And then we start tackling the home. So that is the debt snowball method. And that's an easy way to feel like you're getting wins as you continue to go. The avalanche method mathematically can be more beneficial because this looks at interest rates. So the avalanche method says, okay, I'm going to look at my highest interest rate debts and I'm going to pay those off first because I'm paying the bank higher interest rates. So that's also a good method. I'm just more of a snowball method person because of the mental aspect of it and getting those wins as I'm paying things off. Because it feels really good when you're paying off debt to pay them off. I almost would say I've never felt better, but I have. But it felt really good to pay off my student loan in December of last year. I really, really liked that. All right, so now we're going to get into car ownership and what that looks like. So there's really two options when you're looking at purchasing a car. You can lease it or you can buy it. So some of the common pros for car ownership leasing is you have a lower payment. So a lot of times when you go and look at a car, you might not be able to afford the cost of ownership. Hey, you have a lower monthly payment with a lease. Okay, there's no maintenance costs. Okay, and the lease is under a warranty. So anytime you need service or anything, there's built in to your payment essentially on that maintenance cost. Okay. And it's easy to transition cars. Every 2 to 3 years, whenever that lease is up, you go and you get the next car. And then they're going to give you another little payment. And you're going to be in that cycle all the time. Hey, I can get a new car I'm in a lease. These are popular leases or popular for like business owners and their own businesses. Some business owners believe in leasing rather than owning, and there's reasons for that. But some of the dangers of leasing, like for me, I drive a lot, and the mileage limitation would not be beneficial to me. Most of the time, they're 10, 12,000 miles, sometimes 15,000 miles a year. So if you don't drive a whole lot and you're guaranteed not to drive a whole lot, then leasing might be okay. But it does have limitations on how much you can use it, use that car. You're going to end up paying more in the long run. We'll go through an example that shows you the math on what it looks like. And then wear and tear unknown until you turn it in. So they can charge you for if your kids or mess up the seats in my life, or if your friend gets in and something in his pocket scratches the leather seats, or whatever wear and tear happens in the car, they can charge you for that. And then if you want decide, hey, I don't want this lease anymore, there are early termination costs. And the most important one for me is you don't own the car. I'm a proponent of owning. So you won't, you're just leasing it. It's not your car. So what are the pros of buying a car? It is your car. So you get to do what you want to it. Even if you have a loan on it, it's still yours. You still own that car. Okay? You'll see in just a minute that it is lower cost in the long run. There are no mileage limitations, so you can drive it to California and back, then to New York and back, and no one's going to stop you from doing that, okay? And you can sell it whenever you want. You don't have any limitations on if you decide, hey, I don't like this car in 2 years. Now, you might get upside down on it if you have a large loan, but hey, you're free to sell it with no penalties for selling it. So what are some cons? It can be a higher monthly payment if you're not paying cash for that car. Okay, you can have buying and selling hassles. That can be a problem. And then cash is tied up in a car versus investments. So those are some things to think about when you're thinking about buying or leasing a car. Can you all see that okay? It's kind of small. I try to make it as big as I possibly can, but I'm going to kind of go through it. So this shows the same exact car. I think we used a Honda Civic, and everything is neutral. Okay, the only thing difference is lease versus buy versus loan. Okay, so the yellow is loan, so you got 100% car loan in yellow. You have a lease in red, and you have buying it outright in cash in green. Okay, so you have lease payments of $289 a month, which was kind of the average for the Honda Civic. So you look at the total cost. Remember, there are no maintenance costs or anything like that. You're paying your lease payment, and at the end of 5 years, you've paid $17,340 for that lease. And then at the end, you can say, I want to buy that car or not, but then that's extra cost. But anyway, for the lease itself, you paid $17,340. Okay, let's go to the yellow. So we have maintenance cost of $193, and then inflated over the few years, that gives you a total cost of $1,451. And these were just average maintenance costs with some inflation on it. And then you have your interest. Your interest totaled for the car loan, $7,597. And then the principal balance was $30,797. But remember about car ownership. Instead of turning it in 5 years, we have the opportunity to sell it. So we sold it for the depreciation on the car, so we got $24,000 out of it. So the total cost that car loan over 5 years cost us was $15,492, so less than the lease. So even though we had a higher payment, the payment was $587 versus the $289, over those 5 years we're better off because we had an asset to sell. Okay, and remember what I talked about earlier, that is a slowing depreciation asset is not a terrible debt to be in. Okay, and here's the math to show you why. So it's less than leasing, even though you're paying a higher monthly premium, but you own something. the last one over there in the green is going to be the least expensive option long term, and that's buying a car outright in cash. So this shows we paid $30,997, just like we did when we financed the car. So we still have the same exact maintenance costs, but then we get to sell it at the end. The big thing here is we're not paying any interest because we bought it outright. So the total cost to us was $7,902. So that's significant when you look at it. So how do we get to the point where we can actually pay cash for a car? And Kurt shared this with me. It's something that I did without knowing I was doing. And I liked his on how he did it and how he got there. So depreciation on cars. So you purchase a car for $20,000 in January, and then you sell it to a friend for $15,000 in 2027, so 2 years later. So that car cost you $5,000 over 3 years just due to depreciation. So the car's not worth as much anymore. You got to use it. So if you calculate that per month, that's $138.88 per month. Okay? Now, a good idea is always whenever you have finally paid off your first car and you're going to continue to drive it for a while, continue paying yourself a car payment. Okay? And then by the time you're ready for a new car, you have some money where you can pay cash or pay a large down payment. Now, that's what advice I was given when I was in college, and that's what I started to do. And Kirk, when we were meeting this week, he was like, I just view it as depreciation. And he just bought a new truck recently. And he said, I bought my first truck in 2018, and I knew it was going to depreciate by this much, so I started saving that per month because I knew the depreciation. It's going to be costing me that dollar amount every day. I said, I've never thought about it in depreciation. I've just put money aside without any rhyme or reason. But anyway, I think that's a really good idea, is because you can find kind of the average depreciation of the type of car that you have and how long you expect to own it and start putting that money away. And then when it comes time for his next truck this year, he was able to pay cash because he sold his truck plus the depreciation expense that he had was able to cover that new truck. So the biggest part of car ownership is to make a plan. You want to be able to be smart about paying a car. You don't want to just go out there and buy a Mercedes because you like the way it looks. If it makes more sense to buy the Toyota or the Honda. Okay. So you want to save each month. You want to calculate how much you can actually afford. Like I said earlier, if you go to a car dealership and they're like, well, if you can afford $500 a month, well, we'll just stretch that thing out over as many months as we possibly can. Again, that's to their best interest as the bank to be able to receive as much interest payments as they possibly can. So home ownership, a couple things and items to start with is homes typically rise in value. We talked about this before. So especially in the DFW area, we can pretty much understand that homes are going to rise in value. Okay, but most of us need to borrow for a home, and it is a long-term commitment. So a lot of people will go and purchase a home, and then they're 3 or 4 years into it, and they're like, well, I don't like living in here. I don't like this area of town. And so it's important to be thoughtful when you're purchasing a home. Don't just purchase a home to purchase a home because your friends are purchasing a home. And it's not always the best decision. Sometimes it makes more sense not to own your home. Okay, some costs to be aware of in home ownership. So I remember when I bought my first home, this is not a good story on myself, but I did it anyway, and it was fine. But I spent every single penny I had and bought a house when we moved here from West Texas. And I forgot about closing costs. That's why I had to spend everything. I knew I had, okay, I have my emergency fund, I have how much money I have for my down payment, and then I get to the closing table, and they're like, you need to write us a check for X number of dollars. And I was like, what? What is that? And so that was closing costs. I didn't anticipate as much closing costs as I had. So whenever you're purchasing a house, make sure you understand all of the costs that go into it. There are a lot of fees. There's title fees, realtor fees, home loan fees for the banks, appraisal fees that you have to pay. So all that can be negotiable, but there are fees that you have to pay, and they add up very, very quickly. So I kind of slapped myself on the wrist for not being educated when I went and bought my first house. My second home, I knew what I was doing, and I learned from my mistakes. So learn from my mistakes. Don't make the same mistake I did. Understand. Make sure you're asking the mortgage person, asking the realtor, what the fees are, what are the closing costs going to look like. Make sure you have a good understanding about that. Some other costs to be aware of after you actually purchase the home. So you have property tax. In the state of Texas, property taxes are high. We don't have a state income tax, so you're going to have property taxes. Even when you pay off your home, you still have to pay property taxes. Another thing that I learned about, my mortgage broker on my first house messed up the calculation and forgot. This was a bad mortgage broker, I guess, but he forgot to add in the school district tax. So my tax, he was like, oh, I'm so sorry, I made a mistake. So your taxes actually are double what you thought they were. So school district taxes are a thing. So you have property taxes and school district taxes when that's lumped into a... Another thing that you could have property tax-wise, it's very prevalent right now in our area, new homes that are being built. They have created special taxing districts. Some are called PIDs. Some are called MUDs. But essentially what that is there's an extra tax that you're going to have to pay. And what the builders did is they issued bonds to be able to put in the gutters and the roads and all of that sort of thing for these new neighborhoods. So I know a lot of friends that go here, of my friends that live like in Justin, that live in kind of the North Lake area, that's very, very common. So just know that hey, it's going to cost me an extra X number of dollars to live here. And is that worth it to me or not? Again, that gets into the planning thing. Just understand, and you can look up. An easy way to do it is whenever you're purchasing a home is look up on the county appraisal, and it'll show you every single taxing district that you have and the amount from the previous year. So that's good research to do on your own when you're thinking about purchasing a home. Home insurance, so you have home insurance that you're going to have to pay. Again, if you have a mortgage, have to. Even when you don't have a mortgage, still a good idea to have homeowners insurance. And then some neighborhoods have homeowners associations or HOAs that you have to pay dues into. And so that's all things that come into the decision when you're deciding where to live. All right, cost to be aware of after purchase continued. So every month you're going to have utilities. So one thing that I learned when I bought my second home is the people that we bought it from, I asked them for all their utility expenses from the prior year, because we bought our house in, I think, April. And that bill is a lot different in March and April than it is in June, July, December, January, when you have to utilize a lot more electricity. So she could have given me March, and I would have been like, oh, great. They probably didn't even turn on their AC in March because we have good weather most of the time. So having that full year, you can kind of see, okay, what are my average costs going to be utility-wise? Some homes are more efficient than others. So we moved into a newer home, and our utility bill actually went down. It was a bigger house, newer house, but our utilities actually have gone down. And I've been there a full year now, and I'm kind of math nerd, so I looked. And so that plays into account. So make sure you have a good understanding on utilities. Lawn and garden, you have to keep your lawn mowed if you're not going to do it yourself. How much is it going to cost? $30 is probably a little low. It's usually $30, $40, $50, $60 sometimes if you have a big yard. So, and if you buy a lawnmower, that's going to cost you, with a weed eater and everything, maybe $1,000. So those are costs that you have to intend for. So other random costs that happen are air conditioners, and air conditioners are expensive. If you have a two-story house, sometimes you have two air conditioning units. So if one goes out, those are very expensive to replace. hot water heaters. Again, I had one of those go out, and I didn't realize how expensive they are. And then they're very expensive to have someone come out and actually put it in for you. So unless you're handy and can do it yourself, that's another added cost to the hot water heater. Roofs are expensive. So going back to the homeowner's insurance and what's happening today in our area, what used to be a 1% deductible on wind and hail on homeowner's insurance is now 2% and 3%. So what that means is if your house is insured for $400,000, what used to be a deductible of $4,000, which is 1% of the value, is now $8,000 or $12,000. Okay? The reason for that is insurance companies in Texas are starting to view us like Florida, where we're higher risk because of all the wind and hail. So you might get a homeowner's insurance agent whenever you're buying a home and saying, oh, well, my policy is only $1,500, but everyone else is quoting you $2,500 or $3,000. Well, make sure you understand what those deductibles are. And in the state of Texas, the most common threat to your house is wind and hail damage. So that's important. Most insurance companies now, I can't find any that even have a 1% deductible. So it's usually 2 or 3 now, and it is what it is. And they have gotten more expensive. So not only are they more expensive, but your deductible is higher too. So that's the joys of living in Texas with homeowners insurance. And then you have appliances like refrigerators, dishwashers, ovens. You kind of get the picture. I mean, homeownership is not cheap. Do we still have time? Are we good? Are y'all still good, or you want me to stop? Okay. So this gets into what the math actually looks like. And again, it's pretty small, and I'm sorry about that. I tried to make it as big as I could. So I'm going to read this example to you. So the purchase price of this house was $375,000. Okay, the down payment was $75,000, or 20% of the value. So you do a mortgage or a loan amount of $300,000. So this is the difference between doing a 30-year mortgage and a 15-year mortgage. 6.5 or 5.9 are the two interest rates. So on the 15-year, it's the lower amount. Oh, I see it now. On the 30-year, it's higher. So on the 30-year mortgage, 6.59, which I think rates have come down enough where that might be right, closer to 7%. So your monthly payment is $1,900 of that $300,000. And so it shows the total principal you paid at the end of 30 years was the $300,000. And the total interest, this is where interest hurts, is $389,000. So you paid for that $300,000 house over the length of your 30 years, $689,000. So Kirk talked about compound interest and investing. Well, it works the exact same way on the bank side. So on your interest, it's just compound interest working against you. So the quicker you are to pay off stuff, the better on interest savings. So on a 15-year mortgage, typically they let you do a less interest rate because you're a less risky borrower if you're doing a 15-year mortgage because you're paying more every month. So you probably have more income to qualify for that 15-year mortgage. And your monthly payment instead of $1,914 is $2,514. So again, $300,000 in principal and $152,000 in interest. So for that exact same house, you paid $236,000 less just by doing a 15-year mortgage versus a 30. There are lots of other strategies you can use other than just doing a 15-year mortgage. Some strategies are you can pay biweekly, meaning you're paying every other week. So a lot of us get paid biweekly, so every 2 weeks we're getting paid. And so you pay a portion of half of that mortgage payment every 2 weeks. And that essentially at the end of the year, you've paid a full extra payment by doing that. So that's one way to really take off some interest in the year. Some other people just put extra onto the amount. So they pay, if my payment's $1,900, maybe I pay $2,000. If it's just a little bit can help a lot and take off a lot of years. Banks typically want you to pay for your home insurance and real estate taxes. So this is what we call escrow. So Essentially, what you do is you lump your property taxes, your insurance, and your principal and interest payment into one payment. I like having control of my money and not allowing them to have it. So I pay my homeowner's insurance policy one time a year, and I pay my property taxes one time a year. And if I escrowed that, I would give the bank the control of my money when it's not even paid out except twice a year, once for property insurance, once for taxes. Insurance and taxes. So what I do is I accrue that in a high yield savings account. So when it's time this next month to pay my homeowner's insurance policy, I've accrued interest on all that money that the bank would have made money on, but I've made money on it because I've kept it myself, and then I'll write a check. Typically, you cannot do that unless you do 20% down, I think. Most lenders want to see you escrow. I mean, they're going to haggle with you on interest rates and say, oh, well, we'll give you a better interest rate if you escrow with us instead of paying it out of yourself. So, again, first-time home buyers, I wouldn't have a huge case of heartburn if you had to escrow, but it's better if you don't have to, and if you're good at keeping track of your money, because what you don't want to happen is get to the end of the year and you don't have enough money to pay your taxes. So if you're not good at tracking your money or it's new to you, it might be beneficial to escrow, but just know the bank's able to make money on those dollars instead of you. Okay, so the next bullet point, we talk about how you're taxed on any gain from your house. So if it's your primary residence and you've lived there 2 years or longer, then you have limits on gain. I think for singles, it's $250,000. For marrieds, it's $500,000. So if you bought your house for $100,000 and 3 years later you sold it for $250,000, well, you have $150,000 worth of gain. That is not taxable if that's your primary residence and you've been there 2 years or longer. Now, if you bought a house for $100,000, 9 months later you say, I'm sick and tired of this and I don't want to live here, well, and your house went up to $150,000, you're going to have to pay tax on that $50 worth of gain. The only exceptions to that are like if your company moves you to another place, then there's an exception where you won't have to if you have to sell your house within that time due to a job change, military, things like that. All right, so this is the big recommendation on homeowners that I'm going to talk about one more time, to make sure you're happy with the location before you buy the house. So go drive around the area. A lot of people, if they're like new to DFW, if they move from a different state or from Houston or San Antonio, maybe rent an apartment for 6 months in the location you think you're going to like living in. Get to know the area, make sure that that is an appropriate location for you, because once you buy your home, it's a long-term commitment, or it should be. If you can't buy a home with cash, try and do a 15-year mortgage. If you can't do a 15-year mortgage, pay every 2 weeks, pay extra on the principal, try and get that paid off as fast as possible, especially in environments like we have today where interest rates are so high. I would totally have a different recommendation if we were in 2021 where we were getting new mortgages at 2.75, 3%, because my investing brain says I can make way more money investing than I can paying down this debt. Again, that's a preference thing, but mathematically it makes sense. But when interest rates are 6.5, 7%, pay down on that debt because it's going to cost you a lot of money. Don't let a banker or real estate agent tell you how much house you can afford. That is huge. A lot of people will go to a realtor and say, here's how much money I make, how much house can I afford? And they're going to tell you way more than you can actually afford. So do the budget, understand how much it costs you to live, what you can actually afford, and don't go with what the bank will lend you, because most of the time it's more than what you can actually afford. And then you become what we call house poor, where you can't do anything else because you have an obligation to pay a mortgage. Right now, interest rates are really high. There's talk about them coming down. What does that look like? I think that's a preference thing. I don't think you can have a right or wrong answer. If we expect interest rates to go down over the next couple of years, then maybe you refinance. Maybe it makes sense to do that. If you want to own a home now, you're building equity, that kind of thing. So you are building an asset, even though interest rates are a little bit higher. A guy that I serve with on financial counseling, Gary Dunlap, he reminds me all the time that his first mortgage payment or first interest was like 9-point-something%. And his neighbors were like, how did you get such a low rate? So it's all perspective and what we are. But anyway, yeah, that's the answer.